There's another major headache for Alec Baldwin, and this one comes with animation. The late husband of the cinematographer who was killed on the set of his movie Rust filed a wrongful death lawsuit against him today and against the production Rust as well. Helena Hutchins' husband, Matthew, filed the suit in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the state where the shooting happened. But in a really unusual twist, the suit comes with this, a movie production of its own, an animated clip that shows what Hutchins' family says happened to Matthew's wife on that set that day inside that church. That's Alec Baldwin in, you know, imagery. And this is a warning. The images are a bit shocking. They show the moment that Alec Baldwin pulled his gun in what was called a cross-draw maneuver and then fires it. The cinematographer and the director are shown taking fire. And then the plaintiffs end up breaking down how both victims were shot by one bullet using this CSI-like approach in the graphics. In court documents, Hutchins says Baldwin recklessly shot and killed his wife and that the Rust production failed to follow basic safety protocols that are just standard in the industry. Look at this graphic depiction. It's just remarkable, showing again how that bullet went through Hutchins and then into the movie director, the gaffer scene there, helping Hutchins afterwards. And we've actually spoken to some of the people who were actually present at the time, just about the emotional moment that that was, and that's the exterior of the church set. The suit went on to say this: Helena Hutchins deserved to live, and the defendants had the power to prevent her death if they had only held sacrosanct their duty to protect the safety of every individual on a set where firearms were present, instead of cutting corners on safety procedures, rushing to stay on schedule, and ignoring numerous complaints of safety violations. The lawsuit is seeking unspecified damages, but also punitive. They want that money. The death of Hutchins is also being investigated in New Mexico, but so far criminal charges have not been filed yet. Don't even know if they will be. And there's been an unusual response from Baldwin's lawyers. It was sort of, you know, maybe what you'd expect, actually. Kind of basic, that Alec Baldwin, they deny that that he was reckless in all of this. But just a fascinating development with that lawsuit, that this movie, you know, group of movie producing people decided to produce a movie to go with that lawsuit. Okay, and if you are looking forward to seeing Prince Andrew under oath and answering questions about sex, you can put away your popcorn because it's not going to happen. The prince has reached a settlement with Virginia Giuffre, that woman who is suing him for sexual abuse in New York. The financial terms of this deal are staying under wraps, folks. But it does sound like Giuffre got the prince to make some really serious concessions. To be clear, Prince Andrew is not admitting to anything, and he's taking no responsibility for what Virginia says he did to her when she was 17. But he is singing a very different tune about her. Just a couple months ago, he and his team were accusing her of zeroing in on a big payday. Today, however, a statement from the prince in court records states that, quote, Andrew intends to make a substantial donation to Ms. Giuffre's charity in support of victims' rights, that he, quote, never intended to malign Ms. Giuffre's character, and that he, quote, regrets his association with Epstein and commends the bravery of Ms. Giuffre. He goes on to say he, quote, pledges to demonstrate his regret for his association with Epstein by supporting the fight against the evils of sex trafficking and by supporting its victims. If the judge signs off, and there's no reason to think the judge won't, but if, the case could be wiped off the books in 30 days. So 30 days is one period of time, 10 years is quite another. And it has been 10 years, but justice, or at least a small version of justice, has come in the form of a big payout for families of those who were murdered in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Today, Remington, the now bankrupt gun manufacturer, and its four insurers agreed to pay a $73 million settlement to the families of five children and four adults who filed a wrongful death lawsuit. Their loved ones died after a 20-year-old gunman used a Bushmaster AR-15 assault-style rifle to shoot 20 school children just ages 5 and 6 years old, and another six adults at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. In addition to the money, the families are allowed to make public Remington's internal corporate documents that they say prove the company's wrongdoing and may, in fact, help prevent future mass shootings. Despite a federal law protecting gun manufacturers from lawsuits like this one, the families won this suit based on the marketing approach of Remington. They said Remington advertised the image of a combat weapon in violation of Connecticut's deceptive marketing laws. Still to come, more than a half million Americans are now living on the street, and the homeless crisis is only expected to get worse. But should families be expected to let the homeless move in with them? That is the plan in several U.S. cities. What could possibly go wrong? Welcome back to Banfield. There are so many names for it. It's been an issue. It's been a situation, a mess, a crisis, an explosion. I'm talking about the homeless problem in America. But despite all the different ways they've come up with to describe it, our lawmakers never seem to come up with a way to solve it. There are right now more than 580,000 homeless people in America. That is over a half million folks. And while you might be surprised by the size of that number, you're probably not surprised by the size of the problem. Anyone who has been to a major U.S. city lately has seen it. People are asleep on the street. People are asking for money on the corners. And the groups erecting massive tent cities in fields and on roads and under bridges. Most of the homeless population, about 70%, are just single individuals, with the rest living as families with children. Which is why a one-size-fits-all approach is a really tricky thing and doesn't work. But that hasn't stopped our lawmakers from trying. Over the years, they've treated the homeless like a nuisance or like victims and even like criminals. But none of those approaches have done the trick. So now, they're trying something different. They're treating the homeless like tenants. And they want all of us to be the landlords. How about that? In San Francisco's Bay Area, where there's a homeless population of more than 35,000, some lawmakers and multiple charities are asking local families to open up their doors and let the homeless move in with them. Will it work? Would you do it? Is this really the safest and most effective solution? I'm joined by Richie Greenberg, a former mayoral candidate in San Francisco, who calls the idea unrealistic and downright creepy. Christy Carpenter, she's the executive director of the East Bay nonprofit Safe Time, which places homeless families and college students in spare bedrooms. And Alex Buzanski is the founder and president of Impact Justice. His group provides subsidies to homeowners in exchange for renting a room at an affordable rate to somebody returning home from prison. So welcome all three of you. Thank you so much for joining. Christy, I'm going to begin with you. 35,000 homeless people in the Bay Area, and you've placed 60 people since 2017, which, by the way, congratulations, that's laudable, but holy Dinah, 60 compared to, you know, 35,000, it's a drop in the bucket. Are there enough Good Samaritans even out there?
Not yet. Well, I think they're out there, and I hope that we can help more people know about programs like Safe Time, which it's a host home program that houses unhoused people, as you mentioned, in people's homes. And we are looking for more hosts. And, you know, the more people who find it in their hearts to open up their home to someone who is on the streets, the smaller that homeless population becomes. But I think you're right that we certainly can't do it just on individuals' homes. But I do hope that we can change the narrative around homelessness so that our homeless neighbors are no longer seen as criminals or, you know, dangerous or, you know, nuisances, but rather, you know, those are our neighbors and we all need to help each other out in our communities.
Well, you know, call it the danger of a headline or call it what you will, but if you live in New York City, you see things like the homeless man that shoves somebody onto the tracks because they're mentally disturbed. And the first thing you get a reaction is, are you kidding me? What could possibly go wrong? Well, people and children in those homes, you know, could get hurt. So, Richie, jump in here. When you said creepy, I assume you sort of fall into that the basket of folks who say, this is the dumbest thing ever.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. Let's not say dumbest thing, but, you know, first of all, in San Francisco, anyway, a very high percentage, some put it at 60, 65% of those homeless are mentally ill, suffering from a mental illness or drug addiction, or one feeds the other. So if we look at that, it would be wholly unrealistic to have any of those individuals who are addicted to drugs, the tents that we see right now on the screen here, those are not really for dwelling. That's often to be able to partake in their drug habits. San Francisco has thousands of these, and that's a real big problem. You cannot have these individuals in a well-meaning person's home. It is unsafe. It's unrealistic. It's very different from bringing in someone who is down on their luck, or a student, or perhaps even someone who is previously incarcerated as coming out of the justice system. This is a very different situation here. And that's the situation that we're finding now, that there are many politicians who are running for office, including in San Francisco, this year and next year, who are trying to find some way to curry favor with voters with these kind of proposals when they really have very, very little chance of success.
So, Alex, you know, on the list of people you might not want to open your door to if there were just a stranger knocking, someone who's homeless might be pretty high, and definitely an ex-con who just, you know, got out of prison would be on that list too. And yet you're able to find people who open their hearts and bring in your clients and give them a safe place. Is it tough? Does it work? Has it backfired?
So at Impact Justice, my organization, our initiative is called the Homecoming Project. We place people who have been in prison for at least 10 years into homes of people who have an extra bedroom, and we pay those people a stipend on a daily basis to take individuals in. And we provide some wraparound services using essentially community navigators, life coach-like people. They'll support the homeowner and the people inside the home and the participant who goes into that home. We find it extraordinarily successful. We have certainly high demand of people getting out of prison, right? They've been in for more than 10 years. We know a lot about them. We know a lot about the hosts. We interview everybody. We try to make good matches. Our biggest problem in keeping hosts isn't that there are problems. In fact, we've had no problems of any significance. 0% recidivism for people we've placed. The biggest problem is that the hosts and the participants create such a good relationship that the hosts go on to enter into a long-term housing relationship with those people.
Well, that doesn't sound like a problem at all. That sounds pretty successful. I'm not sure if the homeless will, you know, translate the same way as ex-cons, but Christy, the one thing I'm sure everybody watching right now is, what is the vetting process? Because there isn't one of us who hasn't walked down a street and thought, yikes, I think I might cross the street. I'm a little afraid of how that person's behaving. So how do you vet to make sure that there's not a really bad headline that comes out of one of these matchups?
I want to, you know, first start off by saying that, you know, being unhoused is not a crime. And there are many reasons why a person would end up unstably housed or unhoused. And many of those are not a reflection on that person's character. And so I also want to, you know, acknowledge what my colleague is saying, just that, like, not everyone who is unhoused is a good candidate for a host home program. And the idea is not to solve, you know, the homelessness issue with one, this one solution, which is host homes. But we do believe that there are people who are unhoused, who could very safely and comfortably and in a positive way move into someone's home. I'm a host myself. I've been hosting for the last 5 years, and I've also never had any problems of significance and have had some wonderful relationships result.
Now, so Richie, I think, Christy makes it. Go ahead, Christy.
I was going to say, of course, the vetting process and the support along the way is really important. In our host home program, the host and the guest meet multiple times before move-in occurs, and both need to agree that it is a good match. We do that in addition to background checks and reference checks. Ultimately, it is the decision of the host and the guest for the move-in to happen. No one is forced against their will, even once they sign up for the program, to take a specific individual.
But you make a good point that there are a lot of people who, you know, are they don't fall into that category of scary or dangerous or troubled or mentally ill. But Richie, I do want to read from the National Homelessness Law Center what the five main causes of homelessness are: lack of affordable housing, unemployment, poverty, mental illness and the lack of needed services, substance abuse and the lack of needed services. And so when I see stats like that, I think, you know, God bless Christy, but where the hell is the government? Where the hell is the, you know, the leadership to do what these people, God bless them, shouldn't have to do? They shouldn't have to open their own doors and you know, fix the societal problem of homelessness. This is created from the top. It should be fixed at the top. Where are they?
Well, you brought up actually a very good list of the different categories, and I was actually going to mention that on my own, that what tends to happen is you lump politicians and others lump all the different categories of the type of homeless unhoused into one, and they say we have 30,000-35,000 unhoused homeless in the Bay Area, and we need funding. Well, in reality, when you look at the specific types of homeless, you have those who are the drug addicts and those who are mentally ill, suffering from mental illness. Then you have some that are down their luck. They just lost their job. They were living paycheck to paycheck, and they're good people, and they maybe are crashing on someone's couch or an extra bedroom already. Then you have the families that also have down on their luck. They have the kids that they're trying to put into school, and they're living in their car. Then you have a whole segment of homeless who are homeless by choice. They want to participate in this off-the-grid mentality where they like living in a tent and they don't want to be bothered. They don't want any government handouts, and they just want to be urban camping. So there are multiple types, multiple categories of homeless. And so what we really need to do is we need to hone in, and focus on those that need the help the most. The problem is that the nonprofits that are in San Francisco anyway, that are tending to those that are most in need, meaning the drug addict and the those suffering from mental illness, a lot of the homeless organization, outreach organizations, are mismanaged, are coming under fire for wasting taxpayers' money.
I have to wrap it there, unfortunately, but I could talk about this all day, because I just find this to be such a sad statement of who we are as a first world nation. Christy Carpenter, Richie Greenberg, and Alex Buzanski, thank you all. Really appreciate it. Right now, about 1% of babies born in the United States are to mothers older than 45. And while that may not sound like a lot, it equates to 36,000 plus newborns last year alone. And that is four times the number from the 1990s. Before that, it hardly happened at all. Take that, greatest generation, we're here. So are today's oldsters made of sterner stuff, or were they just too busy or too poor or self-absorbed to reproduce in their prime? The answer is no and no. Today, between in vitro fertilization, surrogacy, egg freezing, and old school adoption, age is not the ultimate barrier to parenthood, or at least to becoming a parent. Teaching a toddler to walk when your own knees are giving out is definitely not for everybody, but mentally, emotionally, financially, a lot of older parents say they are much more fit for the job now than they ever were in their youth. After the break, you're going to meet a woman who became a mom at 50 after years and years of trying, and a psychologist who will tell us whether older really does mean wiser. Stay with us. Time to talk about that awkward age. You have the desire, the energy, the wherewithal to share your life with a child, but your body has closed up shop. In generations past, that was that. But now tens of thousands of women who are old enough to be empty nesters are filling their nests like never before in multiple ways. Liz Layton, for instance, she is a well-established, highly successful TV producer in New York. And she's the proud mom of this little guy. Oh, Walker. He was born last March when Liz was 50 years old. Dr. John Duffy is clinical psychologist and best-selling author whose latest book is Parenting the New Teen in the Age of Anxiety. Welcome to both of you. All right, Liz, I'm going to begin with you. So how was it being pregnant when you were 50?
It was awesome, Ashley. I mean, I am an oldster, but I am a happy, fulfilled oldster. My knees are still working. My son decided to walk at 9 months. So he is literally keeping me on my toes.
Lord, you lose the baby weight quick, don't you, when they start walking that early? You just never get a moment's peace. I can't believe I can even remember it, but I can. So it took, what, 2 years of IVF to do this, which must have been, I would think, mentally exhausting, but also physically it takes a toll.
Mentally, physically, financially, every E. It was hard. I have a very supportive husband, an amazing doctor, and both of them were pivotal in encouraging me to keep going. And all the while, the decision was mine. No one, you know, it's one of those things, you really got to want it. You've got to really want it. You've got to keep your sense of humor. You need to understand that, you know, you can't ride the roller coaster. You just have to really try to keep calm. And every day is sort of a new discovery. You don't know what you're getting into until you're in it, right? It was very hard, but very worth it in the end.
Liz, did you get anybody giving you the, you know, stink eye or anything like that, whether it's family members or friends or just someone at the bus stop?
Well, luckily I was pregnant in COVID, so no one saw me. So
that's good.
Maybe I would have gotten the stink eye, but no, everyone was so supportive. All my mom friends, which are pretty much all my, you know, college and high school friends, were so excited for me. My family was ecstatic. They were probably more nervous for me than anybody, but everyone led with positivity because they knew that we really wanted this and they were rooting for us for sure.
So, Dr. Duffy, I want you to jump in here, and I'm going to throw some more celebrity, you know, at the fridge here and see if it sticks. But Steve Martin said something that I just thought was really, you know, insightful. He became a first-time dad at 67. Granted, he didn't have to carry that, you know, giant sack of potatoes around for the 9 months. But he quoted as saying this, if I'd had a child earlier, I would have been a lousy father because I would have misplaced my attention on my career. Dr. Duffy, do you see a lot of older parents, you know, saying this, that they're so glad they've got focus, they've got, you know, abilities? Is it, you know, older is wiser and more capable at this point?
For sure, Ashley. A lot like Liz is saying, older parents don't feel the need to split focus the way that younger new parents do. In other words, they're either deeply established in their career or at the tail end of their career sometimes. So they feel like they've got the time, the energy, the resources to spend with that young family and be present and emotionally available to them in ways that maybe their younger counterparts aren't present and available.
Yeah, so I'm going to throw another celebrity name out there because I didn't know this and I should have because I'm a huge Rolling Stones fan, but Mick Jagger's 78 years old and he's got a 5-year-old, but he's also got a 51-year-old. And Dr. Duffy, I wondered if you come across that kind of dynamic very much in your practice.
I have a few times come across situations where generations crisscross that way, where the family tree doesn't just flow down. And oftentimes they will, older parents will be wise and smart enough to use their children, their older children, to help out in raising their younger children. And I think there's some brilliance to that and some really like sweet big family memories and a vibe that is derived from that, that doesn't happen sometimes in smaller families where things happen in a predictable, linear way.
Sure. Can you imagine getting your daughter to babysit for you, but she's a grandmother, so you're telling your other daughter that this grandmotherly lady is going to come over and look after you, and she's your sister. It's just the whole thing is a lot to take in. So, Liz, you know, one of the things I thought about was, yeah, you're smarter. You got a lot more patience, or at least you've been able to figure out the patience part. But, you know, we get tired, right? We get tired more than our 20, 30-year-old counterparts. How are you kind of figuring that, you know, blend out?
I was thinking about this earlier because I am tired, but I don't know any different. I am also really excited and grateful. And I also know this is a very short amount of time. He's going to be so young. This is what all my friends tell me. Liz, it goes by so fast. The days are long, but the years whiz by. So don't worry. It's all going to get easier and better. And he is a dream baby. I really have been like blessed with a dream baby, sleeping through the night. I mean, look at that face. Come on. But no, it's, well, it's tiring, but I was also partying in my 20s. So I was probably more tired then, honestly.
True. Good point. I have 10 seconds left, but not before I ask if this is a typo or if you're actually trying to have another one right now.
Yes, It's not a typo. We are embarking on the process. There it is. Everyone thinks I'm crazy except for my husband and my doctor. They are very excited for us.
Girl, you are a stronger lady than I. P.S. I don't believe you're in your 50s. You look like you're 20. Hey, Liz Layton, thank you. Dr. John Duffy, thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
You know, it is not unusual in this country to get a helping hand from reproductive technology for these parents. So, you know, it got us thinking, how many babies are born from assisted reproductive technology in just 1 year in this country? Take a look at those choices and we'll pick your answer and let you know what the real answer is after break. Okay, before the break, I asked you how many babies were born in 1 year from assisted reproductive technology in the U.S. And our answer comes from 2019, and it is... ding, 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 B, 77,256 babies. It took 300,000 plus tries to do that, though. 33% of Americans have turned to fertility treatment or know somebody who has. And IVF can certainly be pretty expensive. It's between $12,000 and $17,000. And if you add in the medicine, it can go up to $25,000 per try. So thanks for being with us, everyone. We'll see you here tomorrow night.